So I want to wish you all a happy year. Here we are in the new part of the year. And it's kind of becoming a tradition that at the beginning of the year, the first chance I have of the year is to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths. It's kind of like going back to basics of Buddhism and kind of starting all over again. We're at the heart of it, the core of it, the root of it. And I'd like to do that today. And for those of you who might not know, the Four Noble Truths are, for many people, are considered the core of what the Buddha had to teach, and that everything else the Buddha taught, and all of Buddhism, in a sense, is an expansion on these Four Noble Truths. And in the Mahayana tradition, the Buddhism of Tibet and China and Japan, Korea, there are some places where they're very strongly emphasized, these Four Noble Truths. The cosmology of the Mahayana is quite elaborate. They have this kind of, you know, they have these concepts of kind of vast galactic space with, you know, all these galaxies and universes out there that have all their own Buddhas, you know. We're not the only world that was lucky to have a Buddha, but there are, you know, millions and millions of, you know, Buddha lands, Buddha fields out there. And the immensity of space and time in some of these Mahayana cosmology is just really immense. And so there's a lot of different Buddhas out there. And each Buddha in all those different Buddha lands always teaches the Four Noble Truths. That's what Buddhas teach. Though each one of them might teach it in a little bit different ways, different words for them. And so, but still, it's the Four Noble Truths. The word truths sometimes is a put-off for some people because it implies a creed, something you have to believe. And you know, this is a tenet. If you're going to be a Buddhist, you have to kind of believe the Four Noble Truths. It might be more useful to think of the Four Noble Truths as four frameworks for understanding the kind of, certainly the Buddha's teaching, but also four frameworks of understanding the spiritual life that can probably be applied to almost any spiritual tradition at all. And if you've been familiar with other ones, you can maybe see how this framework might work. So the first aspect is a discussion about the human predicament, as it's often called, the human situation. And I think most religions, spiritual traditions, have some idea of the human condition that is being addressed. That's kind of the human problem, right? Most spiritual people like to, if there's not a problem, then why, you know? There's kind of a problem, right? And so we start with a problem. And then there's this discussion about what the cause of that problem is, what the cause of this predicament is, what brought it about. And then there's a discussion about the prognosis, the view of how it's possible to have a cure of this problem, to solve the problem, a solution to it, some way to be free of it or something. And then the fourth aspect, the fourth framework for kind of understanding these teachings then are the path leading to that cure or that solution or that liberation or whatever it might be. So there's, you know, to use a medical model, there's the illness, there's the cause, there's a prognosis, and then there's the cure that you have to take. You have to kind of do certain things to be cured. So this is what the Four Noble Truths are in Buddhism. So it's very simple, and it's nothing, I don't think it's anything you have to believe in, or just a framework that seems to be useful of what kind of understanding this is, and make some order about it all. And then every Buddha in every Buddha system, Buddha world, has his or her own understanding of what these Four Noble Truths, or a way of explaining it, and that kind of words for it, vocabulary for it. And in our particular world system that we happen to be born into, our Buddha chose the word suffering for the first noble truth. And the word suffering is understood to be a very general word that covers a lot of different things. It's not one thing. So much so that one modern Buddhist thinker likes to translate the word dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, by the word stress. partly because things that we usually don't think of as being suffering, having suffering as part of it, can be quite stressful. Some people have said that marriage can be a happy time, getting married, but that it's quite stressful. But you wouldn't say, you wouldn't go tell people, "I'm sorry for all the suffering you're having on your wedding day." Usually you don't say that, but you say, you know, "Oh, I understand that it was quite stressful. Maybe you should take it easy now." So there are things which, you know, there's stress built into it, that even when there's a lot of wonderful aspects of it also. And then for our Buddha, the cause of the suffering is craving or thirst or drivenness, clinging. And it's a little bit a tautology, this kind of statements, and you have to understand it that way, that the suffering that's being discussed in the First Noble Truth is that suffering that is caused by the Second Noble Truth. And if you don't understand it that way, you end up into a kind of philosophical quagmire of trying to understand the Buddha's teachings and what suffering actually is. But so you really don't really understand what the First Noble Truth is unless you understand the second one. And it's that suffering, that pain. Some people, one teacher in Thailand called it the squeezing of the heart that results from clinging, grasping. And then the third noble truth is the truth of the ending or the liberation of that clinging or that grasping, the squeezing of the heart. So sometimes it's called the sure heart's release, the release of the heart, the freedom of the heart. And since it's not so easy always to have this release of the heart, in order to unsqueeze the heart, there are these eightfold path that Buddhists are encouraged to practice as a way of doing this. In my mind, the Four Noble Truths are a phenomenally simple framework for the spiritual life. And I want to use that, the idea of simplicity, as a little bit of a springboard for the other aspect of what I'm going to talk about today and come back to the Four Noble Truths, or as a way of talking about the Four Noble Truths. I just came back from teaching retreat, 9-10-day retreat at Spirit Rock that ended yesterday, New Year's retreat. And as these things often are, it was quite wonderful to be there and do the retreat. It was a little bit, anyway, it was quite wonderful. But 92 people, retreatants were there and 4 teachers. One of the strong impressions I had in the opening of the retreat, the opening night, the first day, was the complexity, much more than most retreats that I've gone to. I had a feeling that the complexity of human life had arrived at the retreat. you know, somehow the time of the year, and I don't know, the orange alert, and I don't know what all the things were, but I had a sense that, you know, so much was there. There was a fellow there whose mother had lost her house in the earthquake in Paso Robles. And there was people there who were dying, or could have been dying with chemotherapy. And we're supposed to. One woman who was there last year said she was had 6 months to live. She came back this year. So we didn't. She wasn't saying she was dying anymore. And there were. There was so much, there were people who are pregnant, there were people who are getting married, there were people who had just been married, there were people who were getting divorced, there were people who had been divorced, there were people who had lost someone significant in their life recently. One person there just had lost her husband a month before and was going through that at the retreat. There was someone who left during the retreat and totaled her car on the way back to the retreat. And she was fine, but, you know, it was a little bit, you know, an adventure. And so there's, you know, I've had the sense of the complexity, you know, and also people's minds the first day, you know, people, they talked about it. there seemed to be a lot of momentum, a lot of kind of, I didn't feel at the first day kind of, this was a settled group. And they're just people, right? Just ordinary people, how people are. Maybe it had something to do with being around right after Christmas. Some people say this time of year is kind of crazy for people. But I've done this New Year's retreat for now 11 years or so, and this had this more this character, this quality. And then at the end of the retreat, the contrast was quite something. At the end of the retreat, in contrast to the first day or two, there was a simplicity in the air and a simplicity with the people there and my contact with the people there. And it seemed like so much had been dropped, much of the burden and concerns people had, and so much of the complexity of human life somehow had become simpler or more clarified or purified in some way. And, I mean, a lot of things hadn't changed so much for people. Some of the conditions of their life, the husbands had still died or people were still, you know, whatever. But somehow the way that people were relating to it, the way that people were there, had a much greater simplicity of being as part of it. And often, for many people, a kind of joy in that. And even people who weren't particularly joyful, I loved looking at them because there was kind of this purity and this radiance there in their simplicity that sometimes people couldn't even see for themselves if they're kind of still in their thing too much. And some people have talked about that. They said, I feel so different now at the end of the retreat. Things I was consumed by and preoccupied by at the beginning are so much easier now. And the woman who had lost her husband she had much greater clarity and kind of she was settled in a different way. And the woman who was dying seemed she was kind of radiant and present. All these different kind of things going on there, and kind of simplicity of being at the end. And so then the question is, why? What brought about that simplicity of being in those 9-10 days there at the retreat? And certainly there are kind of maybe some obvious things we could point to that would be true for anybody who did something like this for 10 days, that just being away from a normal life, like kind of like a vacation perhaps, a lot of things kind of settle away a little bit and relax. We get a little distance from many aspects of our life. And that distance sometimes can give us a different perspective. And so we're not caught by things in the same way when we're kind of pressed up against our days kind of really closely. Many of us live our lives claustrophobically. And some of the burden of our lives and the heaviness of our life, difficulty or stress of our life comes from being kind of claustrophobic. And we're doing so much and so many activities and, kind of caught up in the details of life as they are. I remember when I was at the monastery, Tassajara, we wouldn't get the newspaper when it was fresh because we were deep down in the Bintana National Wilderness and, they didn't deliver the paper there. So we only got the newspaper if someone happened to come over the hill. Especially in the winter time, people came over the hill maybe once a week or something. And so it was usually the newspapers there were at least a day old, if not a week old, by the time we read them. And I was struck by how different it is to read a day-old newspaper versus a same-day newspaper. And you might experiment with not reading your paper for a couple of days and then reading it a couple of days later. There's a kind of, you probably won't be as claustrophobic. You probably won't be so intense. The news won't be so intense and so pressing or so important or so, you're not going to grab onto it quite as quickly. This happened a few days ago. I mean, like, what is it to read the sports page, a week late or a month late, you probably don't lean into the papers quite the same way, or whatever it might be. Or the stock market, you read your stocks, you read your stock page, 1 month, 1 week later, a lot happened in a week. So many of us live our lives kind of claustrophobically, so just getting some distance from our life is very helpful, and partly retreats can do that also. But what I would like to suggest is that the biggest change of the retreat was that people began to loosen up on the things they're clinging to, that they're grasping onto. And when people came to the retreat, people were grasping onto a lot of different things, a lot of clinging going on. And clinging is understood in Buddhism to also mean a kind of resistance, kind of pushing things away. And, I don't want to deal with that. So there were people who were clinging to their anger. There were people who were clinging to their self-criticism, since they're clinging to a sense of lack of self-worth. There are people who are clinging to their education. There are people who are clinging to trying to get an education, trying to get into school. There are people who are clinging to their relationships. And the really big thing, talking about the beginning of the retreat, was the relationships they were caught in, and very important for them. People are clinging to their homes or to their jobs or not having a job or not wanting a job or wanting a job or, you know, wondering what to do about a job. And there were people clinging to their spiritual life. You know, this retreat is so important for me. I get to go on retreats very much and I'm going to get enlightened. Or I'm going to, you know, and I know I shouldn't have expectation. I mean, know that really well, but this is an important retreat. I'm going to, you know, touch into that joy that I had in my last retreat. And you know, when people say something like that, you know, it's a setup. And so then they suffer. They come back, you know, a few days later and say, you know, my retreat's not like how it's supposed to be. I'm not on schedule. And so then they get upset or they let go. And they say, okay, I just have to let go of that ideal or that expectation. Some people were clinging to the things they were afraid of, in a sense of trying to hold them at a distance, not wanting to look at it. Or simply holding to fear, things, you know, fearful things, and afraid of the future, or afraid of their fear. All kinds of things people are clinging to and holding on to. And what happens on retreats is that, Vipassana retreats, is people are left alone for the most part. There's no social talking going on. There's almost no talking at all. It's a silent retreat. And there's no television. You can't go out to the movies. And you can't call. You're not supposed to call people and just chat with people. And you're not supposed to read your books. And you're encouraged not to even write. You can't keep a journal. So there's no distractions. You know, there's nothing to really take you away from yourself. And so you're just left with yourself, really clearly. And one of the things that becomes very clear, if you're left alone in that kind of setting, in the early days of the retreat, is how much momentum our life carries with it. And if we're caught up in many things, for example, or just one thing, kind of caught up and frenzied or harried or a lot of clinging, a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety going on, that whatever kind of we do a lot of, the mind kind of carries a momentum, it's kind of wound up in a certain way. And you can't just kind of drop it just like that. But what happens when you come on retreat is oftentimes a person's life catches up to them. And as probably some of you had that experience in your life somehow of not until you stop doing something did you realize you were exhausted. You were kind of doing something, you were lost in the situation. So in the same way retreats do that, both at a kind of macro level, but also at micro levels. The more still the mind can get in meditation, the more on the micro level do you see the momentum that's carrying along. And it's considered very healthy to let your life catch up to you. And to have your life and you separate places is not such a good thing. But to have them together is very healthy. And so your body catches up to what's going on, or your mind, or your psyche. And sometimes when it catches up, it's a little bit uncomfortable for a while, because that's what the nature of the momentum is. And one of the things we start seeing as we sit there and day after day without any distractions, we got to start seeing the grasping that we have, things we're clinging to, often in much better ways than people see it normally. Sometimes people are blinded by their great anticipation of their ultimate wonderful enlightenment that they don't notice, you know, really what's going on in the present moment. But if you really start paying attention to what's going on, one of the things you'll become aware of is the ways in which we cling, or the way we grasp, or the way we're kind of driven, kind of a drivenness. And everybody has it. Everybody, you know, all normal human beings are addicts in some way or other. We might not be addicts in terms of alcohol or things like that, but we might be addicted to our ego. We might be addicted to our thoughts. And so as the mind quiets down, we start seeing some of the places that the mind or the heart is driven, that it grasps, that it holds onto what's going on. And as we pay attention to this, not distract ourselves from it, one of the things that we become aware of is that it hurts to grasp. It, it squeezes the heart. That's in Thailand. Perhaps in America, it just gives us a headache because we kind of hold up there so much. But in various ways, we feel the suffering of it. Sometimes it's very direct in the physical. We feel how the body holds our clinging and our tension in our shoulders or our stomach in different places. But sometimes it's in our mind. Some people on the retreat talked about how painful it was to be in their thinking mind, to be aware of their thoughts. Their thoughts were painful. They were driven, they were angry, they were chasing after things, they were critical. And you can watch the kind of wound upness of the thinking mind. It's just going, and they were just so tired of it. And they wanted to be distracted. So we start seeing, you know, that this clinging hurts. Now, after hearing all this experience from the retreat, probably most of you are thinking, well, I'm never going to go on a retreat. This doesn't sound like fun at all. But part of the medicine of the Dharma is that you have to really understand the illness before you take the medicine. If you don't understand the illness, you might take the wrong medicine. And I think a lot of people will go shopping around for different religious traditions, spiritual traditions, different things to do. And they read great books, and it seems like a really wonderful, profound, fantastic spiritual practice, and you're kind of enamored in this spiritual practice. But it might be the wrong medicine for you. So unless you know what your illness is, how can you know which medicine is appropriate? Are all spiritual medicines, are there some spiritual medicine which is appropriate for all people at all times? Or are there specific ones for different kind of ailments? And also the process of waking up and noticing our life, discovering what's really going on in our life in a very honest, direct way, at least in Buddhism, is the direct way to freedom and to happiness. And so Buddhists specialize at not turning away, not avoiding what's going on, but being very honest about this is what's happening. And the opportunity of retreats is to see that very clearly. I know people on retreats find occasionally, I don't know how often, because I haven't done statistics, but are very happy, or somewhat happy, or at least satisfied, or feel a rightness in feeling how they're suffering. Feeling their particular version of the human predicament, the human situation. How the human forces of addiction, of clinging, or fear manifest for themselves in their individual ways. Great, they get to see it so clearly. And then we can begin working on it. So we see the grasping, we see the clinging, and then we begin to see that it hurts to do that. It hurts to cling, it hurts to grasp. And that's a very important insight, because then it can be a lot easier to want to stop clinging. Because if you don't see that it hurts, why would you want to let go? But if you see that it hurts you, then you start letting go. So to go and retreat, a silent retreat. It's so great, these silent retreats. So there's a story. A person comes to the monastery, and the monk asks, why have you come? And the person says, I've come to experience the great silence. Well, please come in. And then the visitor says, have you experienced the great silence? The person says, I've come to meditate so I can experience the great silence. I want to go in, within, and meditate and explore my inner life and find that deep silence there. Have you experienced the great silence? And the monk says, oh yes, I have. I spent years going in and exploring my inner life and delving in there and different rooms and corners of my mind and experiencing great variety of spiritual states and experiences. And then one day, the abbot of the monastery came over to me and whispered in my ear, come out of there. And I came out and I realized that the great silence was all around me. The noise was inside. So part of, you know, is to look at that noise, to look at what goes on inside, But not to ignore it, but to begin working with it and finding it and quieting enough inside so perhaps we can feel the silence that's all around. So then the third noble truth is that of the liberation of clinging, the end of clinging. And this is considered the good news of Buddhism. And in a kind of colloquial way, we can say this is the truth of happiness. And the way to happiness in the Buddhist path, this certain, the kind of happiness that is kind of unconditioned or kind of happiness that comes from liberation, comes when the mind is no longer addicted or driven or caught up in its preoccupations, or the heart is no longer squeezed or by its concerns. At the end of the retreat, a lot of the people there still had a lot of the same concerns that they had at the beginning of the retreat when things were so complex. But they weren't claustrophobic with it. They weren't caught by it. There was a simplicity about themselves with it, a simplicity of heart in relationship to these issues of their life. So the liberation becomes a simplicity of heart in our relationship to our life that we live. But to go from clinging to not clinging, from grasping and not grasping, to resisting and not resisting, is a huge step. Some things are easy to do, and some things are quite difficult to do. It might be easy for you to let go of, I don't know what, you know. But it might be very difficult to let go of your ego and your sense of self. And there was one, you know, the complexity of the retreat. There was one person on the retreat that I've known for many years, kind of very, very senior person in the Vipassana world. And a lot of teachers have tried to work with him. There's still this narcissism there. You know, kind of caught up in his self-identity and his self sense of self-importance. And, you know, somehow knock, knock, you know, come out. Or, you know, knock. Somehow just doesn't, nothing, he can't hear anything. So it's quite hard sometimes. Another story. In the Zen monasteries, they often have in the meditation hall, they have not the Buddha, but they have Manjushri. Manjushri is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. It's kind of like this archetypical personification of wisdom. And Manjushri often carries a sword in one hand, and sometimes a book in the other hand, the book of wisdom. And the sword is a sword that cuts through our clinging, cuts through duality, cuts through. And this one monastery, they had this statue in the Zendo that was very special. People would talk about it a lot. That somehow if you approach it just the right way, with enough humility and enough maybe reverence or enough presence of mind and stillness, that statue would say something to you, would talk to you. So there was one monk who had been practicing for years and years and years, and he felt he hadn't made much progress for many years. It was hard for him. And he thought, you know, I think I'll go up. I don't know about this Manjushri, but I'll go there. And he went one day when no one else was around, just him and the statue. Because he didn't quite believe it, you know. He didn't want to let other people think that he was going to try to hear a statue talk. But he, you know, he got down and he did three full bows to the floor in front of the statue and stood up there with his hands carefully in front of him, and he looked at the statue. And then the statue spoke. And the statue said, or Manjushri said, "Why not?" That's all he said. Why not? He said it a few times. Why not? And this sent the monk in a kind of, he started panicking a little bit. And he started, because I have so many responsibilities. Oh no, because I have to take care of my siblings. Oh, because I am writing my book. My great book on Buddhism. Oh no, because, you know. Oh no. And Why not? The statue said. And all these excuses came up out of the monk. And then Manjushri leaned down from his up there on the altar, and he handed the monk his sword. And he said, here, take this sword. This sword, you can use it, and it'll cut through all your barriers. And so the monk took that sword back to his room, and he hung it on the wall. And he spent a long time looking at it, thinking about using it, thinking about all his excuses. Why not? And then one day, he took his sword down from the wall, and he snuck back into the zendo, and returned it to Manjushri. He couldn't do it. Such a sad story. Why not? So in terms of your clinging and letting go of your clinging, why not? What's your excuse? Or what's your excuses? If you're lucky enough to have just one, you know, only one, you're good. Why not let go? What are you holding on to? What do you think is really, you know, yes, I can let go of all that, but there were a couple of people in the retreat who I don't do this too often, but I really challenged, like one woman in particular, I really challenged her because she'd been on retreat many years. I think she'd been 8 years with me on this New Year's retreat, and so many retreats before that and around that. And she had certain issues in her life that were a little bit difficult. And, I'd listened to her over these years and worked with her, and, you know, we had a very friendly, good relationship. And I said to her finally, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. This has been a very important part of your life, this Buddhist practice. You come on these retreats, it's not an easy thing to do. We've talked for a long time. And I feel that after all this time, I need to at least, as a teacher, at least remind you or tell you that this practice, the way the Buddha designed this practice, he meant it as a radical challenge to us to get down to the very root of our clinging in our life and uproot it at the very core. So our concerns about, growing old, and, you know, or just our concerns about having enough money, or concerns about whether we're going to be homeless or not, our concerns, you know, are secondary to the challenge of getting down to the core and uprooting our clinging at the very base. I said to her, now that's what the offering of the Buddha, that's what this practice was designed to do. And this is so important for you. I think I should remind you about this at least once. Think about it, I said to her. Maybe you're ready to take that big step. Why not? Says Manjushri. And then there's one scholar who writes about the Four Noble Truths who translates the Pali into English as the Four Ennobling Truths. And I like that a lot because the Four Truths are meant to have a function in our lives. And so they're not just kind of static thing. And the function is to change us, transform us, to ennoble us. And then we come to the last of the Four Noble Truths, which is called the Eightfold Path. And this is the path to be followed, the path that can lead us, help us towards liberation, enlightenment. And the first one is right view, or right understanding, right perspective. And kind of a core to this first one is pointing to the need for each of us to take responsibility for our own lives. Or take responsibility for our own clinging, at least. That no one else is going to do it for us. And so there's a very strong emphasis in Buddhism on this kind of personal responsibility for doing our own practice, for engaging in it, taking it seriously. And in particular, the right view, the first step, is to begin understanding our life in the framework of the Four Noble Truths. and is considered to be a very efficient way of engaging the spiritual life, if you look at your life and are interested in where the stress is, where the suffering is, you're interested in what causes that stress or suffering, you're interested in where the happiness is, where the liberation is, and you're interested in following the path that makes that possible. So it's very simple. You're not looking for the true self or the ultimate self or the ultimate truth or cosmic consciousness. And there's a lot of things that spiritual people look for that maybe are worthwhile, but they're not considered not as efficient as having this metaphysically free view, which is suffering, the cause of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path leading to the ending of suffering. And then the second step of the Eightfold Path is involves beginning to have a change of heart, working on ourselves in a sense to have a change of heart about the way we carry ourselves in the world. And one is to have the kind of to begin moving towards that kind of peaceful freedom, a peaceful freedom from sensual addiction. Our drive and addiction to comfort or to sensuality or sexuality, to have the kind of peace, the peaceful freedom from being driven by that, by sensuality. And then a heart that is also moving away from, so moving towards that kind of freedom and moving away from ill will and tendencies towards cruelty. So the corollaries of that are to develop loving kindness and compassion. So once we have the right understanding, which is kind of a cognitive thing for understanding our life, then we have to also involve our hearts in the practice. And so there's a change of heart, or orientation of the heart, that goes along with this orientation of the view. And then there's the third step, which is right speech, right? I forget the order now. Right speech, and that is to practice not lying, to practice avoiding harsh speech, backbiting, and avoiding empty gossip, or harmful gossip, or gossip. And that's considered to be very helpful if what you want to do is to begin freeing yourself from your clinging. So it's for the purpose of helping you free yourself from that clinging that we begin practicing this kind of right speech. Then the fourth one is right action, which is basically living an ethical life. If you want to be free of the core clinging in your life, it really helps if you live an ethical life. Follow the precepts, for example. And then the fifth one is right livelihood. Since we spend a lot of our day engaged in livelihood, it's good for our livelihood to be in harmony with this direction of moving towards happiness and compassion and freedom, which is part of the goal of Buddhism. So Buddhists then spend some time reflecting a little bit, and is their livelihood in harmony with the spiritual path they're on? And then the sixth, seventh, and eighth are usually considered to be the meditation steps, engaging in meditation, and beginning to cultivate the mind, quiet the mind, concentrate the mind, and develop the mind so you can see very deeply into what's really going on in your heart and your mind. Because it really, in order to do this work in a deep way, you have to really see what's really happening. And I know plenty of people who have fooled themselves in their spiritual life, thinking that they are much more spiritually mature than they actually are, because they kind of focus on one particular aspect of their life, and they kind of have blinders about all these others. Like this fellow who is narcissistic, that he was blinders to that part of himself, but he actually thought he was pretty hot spiritually. And some people have, you know, great spiritual experiences, and really sometimes they even tap into some ultimate sense of reality. But, you know, they don't see it all because it's kind of this. So part of, a very important part of Buddhist spirituality is to develop this kind of mindfulness that can kind of, ideally, be kind of 360 degrees, kind of include all of ourselves and everything we see, what's going on, and develop that. And at least there's the movement towards that, the interest in doing that. and not settling for what our current understanding is, but always interesting more and waking up more and finding out what's going on. I had one more story, but I can't remember it. So maybe it's also 9 o'clock. So a simplicity of being, and simplicity of being that comes when we begin to let down, give up, relax some of our clinging, some things we hold on to. Oh, I wanted to say this about this is that one of the things we can cling to is our spiritual practice. But if you're using, or to Buddhism, but if you're using the Four Noble Truths as a framework to begin understanding your life, then you would tune into how you're clinging to your practice, how you're suffering because of how you're relating to your practice. So built into Buddhist practice is kind of a self-correcting mechanism where you might be a little bit off in how you're practicing. You might be really attached to your practice. But the practice will show you that you're attached. So as a result, the tendency for Buddhists is to take their practice kind of lightly. Take themselves kind of lightly as practitioners. They don't take themselves too seriously or the practice too seriously. It might be the most serious thing they have to do going in their life. But still, there's no reason to take it that seriously. You have to hold it kind of lightly. You might go off and become a monk or a nun and devote your whole life to it. But still, you take it kind of lightly. A lightness of heart. So may the four, this coming year, may the Four Noble Truths help you to lighten your heart and to shine a light onto the path that you will walk as you become happier and freer and simpler. May you all become free. Thank you.